journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, July 29th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
ConocoPhillips sets off a massive profit orgy among oil companies, warns consumer watchdog. The Senate passes a housing relief bill that may still not be enough. And Vera Bodin Saidpour analyzes Turkey's back-to-back bombings.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. On Sunday, two back-to-back bombs went off in the Turkish capital of Istanbul, killing 17 people. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan immediately implied that it was the work of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. But the PKK denied the accusations, and commentators agreed that the bombings were a departure from their usual tactics. According to the PM, the attacks were a, quote, cost of the military campaign against the PKK based in northern Iraq. The PKK is listed by the United States and Turkey as a terrorist group. They took up arms in 1984, ostensibly with the aim of creating a homeland in southeast Turkey. About 40,000 people have reportedly been killed in the conflict over more than two decades. There is speculation that the weekend's bombings were in fact the work of a group of secretive ultra-nationalists known as the Ergenekon. Meanwhile, on Monday, the Constitutional Court in Turkey began deliberations on whether the PM's party, the AKP, was trying to establish Sharia law by stealth. The PM is downplaying the case now, saying that national unity in the face of the bombings is more important. My guest is Vera Bodin Saidpour. She is the director of the Kurdish Library and the editor of Kurdish Life, as well as the editor of the International Journal of Kurdish Studies. Welcome to Uprising, Vera.
Good to be with you.
So first, let's talk a little bit about the PKK and the PM, the Prime Minister Erdogan, immediately linking the PKK to these bombings. Do you think that that's realistic? And if so, what does that mean for the PKK?
I think it is realistic. Hmm. I think despite some of the news reports, if you read the MSNBC report, they said something very, very telling. They said that the attacks occurred in Istanbul, which is essentially, it's a predominantly Kurdish city, Istanbul. But the attacks occurred in the European side of Istanbul. And that tells me that if Kurds were doing it, they wouldn't do it in the Kurdish side of the city. It came within hours of the attacks in northern Iraq by the Turkish Air Force.
What do you make of the Prime Minister saying that this is the cost of the military campaign against the PKK in northern Iraq?
Well, I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true, because initially in the lead-up in 2007, before the attacks began by Turkey, there was a tremendous amount of publicity. The Iraqi Kurdish parties and the Kurdish regional government were complaining vociferously and getting a lot of press attention for the impending attacks by Turkey and saying, well, you have to deal with us directly with the Kurds in northern Iraq, and Turkey refused to do that. And then they said, well, you have to deal with Baghdad. And Baghdad is opposed to these attacks. Well, apparently something happened in the interim. Certainly in the larger scheme of things, the United States has been very interested in courting Turkey's help vis-a-vis Iraq and also vis-a-vis Iran. And so there must have been some kind of an agreement where the Iraqi Kurds were getting some extra perquisites in Iraq in order to keep still about the attacks and to give it really the silent green light and say, well, we'll make a little noise about it, but whatever you have to do, do it. And that's really what's happened. So the PKK has been left in a very precarious position there, because they have been protected from the outset, because their arm, their sister organization, PJOC, has been attacking Iran. So the United States has been, in the initial parts, right after the invasion, has been not only supporting them clandestinely in order that they would do the job against Iran, but the quid pro quo for the PKK was, well, then turn your eyes the other way while we attack Turkey. And now it no longer pays. The same, the same scheme they had before is no longer operative. So the PKK is pretty much left out in the cold. And PJOC, of course, is still doing its business. Its sister organization is still attacking Iran. And so Iran periodically shells Iraqi Kurdistan as well.
What is the dynamic within Turkey? And I want to get back to the PKK in a moment, but just back to these bombings. What is the dynamic within Turkey regarding the sort of nationalist direction, and then also the direction of Turkey more, moving away from its secularist roots toward more of a influence by religion in politics?
Well, I don't think that's really the case. I think that Erdogan has actually been a good prime minister of Turkey. And I think even though he's a religious man, I don't think that Turkey has become more Islamic. Look, they even outlawed the headscarves. I mean, which to me was ridiculous. But they even had to do that. And I think it's always a fight between the Kemalists, who are really the secular nationalists, and any government that's not of their own. This is just, part of the history that continues all the time.
What about the Constitutional Court hearing, looking at this case where the AKP, Erdogan's party, is under scrutiny right now for trying to introduce Sharia law by stealth?
Yeah, well, I just really, that was a total surprise to me, mm-hmm. that the Constitutional Court would even take up a case like that, because it seems to me they're getting a lot of pressure from the secular nationalists. And they really are. The Kemalists have always considered themselves real, and the Kemalists are really led by the military, the Turkish military, the generals, and they have always adhered to the ideology of Kemal Atatürk. And periodically through Kurdish history, even through the 80s, they had military coups to overthrow the government. So I think that the Constitutional Court may be taking up the issue to forestall something like that.
Now, what about this, the ultra-nationalists, as they're being called in the press here, and I'm not sure if that's the same sort of description in Turkey, but this group, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, Ergenekon? What is this organization that is...
I'm not familiar with that organization.
Even the mainstream media here is, sort of reporting it, but all the descriptions about this group are a shadowy, ultra-nationalist...
Well, I think it probably is a shadowy group, because behind... Mm-hmm. Behind the names, behind the overt messages, there's the dynamic of the Turkish generals, which have always considered themselves, quotes, the guardians of Turkish democracy, have always been vigilant against any sign that there was any Muslim anywhere who was going to threaten the government with Islam, who was going to invade the government with Islam, and so. This is a back and forth that's been going on really since the demise of Kemal Atatürk. Mm-hmm. It isn't anything new. It's just the latest manifestation of an old affliction that they have in Turkey. But I really think if the only rationale I could find for the Constitutional Court taking up such a ridiculous issue was that they're afraid of another coup. They're afraid that the generals will decide to take matters into their own hands. And then they would have a tremendous problem in Turkey.
So they're trying to preempt it in a way?
Yeah, I think, no, what they're trying to do is calm the situation down by saying we'll take up this issue, because there really is no legitimate claim that the Erdogan's government is trying to bring the population back into rigid form of Islam. And the headscarves were just, to me, a red herring.
So where does the PKK then fit into the mix between the ultra-nationalists, the secularists, and Erdogan, PM Erdogan's party, politically?
The PKK is a Marxist party. Mm-hmm. So they really don't. They have their own interests in the same way as the Kurds in Iraq, even though they're part of the Iraqi government as set up by the United States. Their interest is not in... ultimately in the Iraqi government, except as it serves their interests. The same thing with the PKK. The PKK is certainly more secular, but the PKK is not interested in the generals attacking them because the generals wanted to bomb. They wanted to bomb northern Iraq before anybody else did.
So is there some sort of unspoken understanding then between the generals and the PKK as well as the United States government?
No. Mm-hmm. I would say the PKK, because they're a sizable population of Kurds in Turkey. They're probably, in the 1980s when I began this work, they were considered 8 to 10 million. They're probably 15 to 18 million Kurds in Turkey. There's a large population. They have their own agenda, and their agenda is to get as far from Turkey as possible. The same thing the Iraqi Kurds want, the same thing Kurds in Iran want. All they're interested in is making enough problems in Turkey so that they can get, at the very least, get autonomy in Turkey, a federal Turkey. That's what they're arguing for, and they're really not on either side.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Vera Bodin Saidpour. She is the director of the Kurdish Library, editor of Kurdish Life, and the editor of the International Journal of Kurdish Studies. We're talking about the bombings that took place in Turkey, in Istanbul, on Sunday. So if we accept what you have said, which is that this work is likely the work of the PKK in retaliation for the fire that they've been coming under in northern Iraq by the Turkish military, then we really have to talk about what is happening in Iraq proper as it is affecting countries like Turkey. Turkey, of course, being just to the north of Iraq. Would that be sort of accurate, that Iraq
really
is the unspoken
case. It really
thing?
Is part of the Kurds' mm-hmm. quest for a greater Kurdistan. That's all of this. All of what you see the Kurds do is misinterpreted because they really have only had one aim and one aim alone, and that's to replicate first the situation that Iraqi Kurds have, which is a virtual autonomy inside of Iraq, and yet strong ties to the Baghdad government through the auspices of the United States. So what they would like to see is the same thing in Turkey, and the same thing in Iran, and the same thing in Syria, so that if you can look at what you see Kurds doing through that lens, you can understand why they're doing what they're doing. And for the PKK now, it's a matter really of kind of a desperation, because they were sitting very pretty in Iraqi Kurdistan for several years since the invasion.
Until they came under fire from the...
Until it became more important for the United States to placate Turkey, right? Mm-hmm. And to allow Turkey to make cross-border operations, which really are within Turkey's right. I mean, Israel, look what they did in Lebanon, because two soldiers were captured. So they made a cross-border operations, and the United States was holding Turkey at bay for several years. They even sent over a General Ralston to placate Turkey and say, we're going to do something about the PKK, until everything came to a head. But the United States held off Turkey for several years to keep them from doing that. And then when they realized, well, now the situation has come to a point where it's more important that we use Turkey for our larger agenda. It's more important, so that they drop the PKK to say, look, they're going to take the hit this time. Even though the PKK was writing all the time, we're doing the best we can for the United States, right? We're keeping the Islamists out of northern Iraq. We're doing what the U.S. wants. And don't forget, these groups, these clandestine groups, these guerrilla groups, are not only supported by the United States through third parties, but they're supported by Israel, especially the sister of the PKK, the Pajak group that attacks Iran. I mean, they're supported clandestinely. In other words, it's the old game: the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
And do you see that these desires for that autonomy that you're mentioning within Kurdish regions in Iraq, Iran, and Turkey as being often used then by countries like Israel, the United States, etc.?
That's right. You hit the nail on the head. Okay. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. That's why they're so amenable to being used, And the tragedy of it all, as one Kurd actually wrote in Kurdish media, and he said, why is Pijak doing this against Iran? Because they're only going to get killed. And I think he was right. They're emboldened by the unusual, extraordinary situation that the United States and Israel have given Iraqi Kurds in the north of Iraq.
Right.
In other words, they're allowed to do things that no other group can do. The militias were supposed to be disbanded, except for the Kurdish militias. The elections that were planned for October, I read in one source, they were going to be elections throughout the provinces, except in the Kurdish north. In other words, the Kurds have become an exception to every rule. And this is because the Kurds are doing, thus far in Baghdad, what we want them to do. If the Kurds suddenly turned about and didn't do what we wanted them to do, I assure you they would be in the same situation as the PKK.
Well, Vera Bodin-Saidpour, I want to thank you very much for helping us to understand some of the dynamics of what's being discussed in the media today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, I sure hope so. I hope I've been of some help. Thank you.
You have. Thank you so much. Vera Bodin-Saidpour is the director of the Kurdish Library and editor of Kurdish Life and International Journal of Kurdish Studies. You are listening to Uprising. Later in the hour, we'll find out whether Congress plans to bring real housing relief amid ongoing foreclosures. And after this short break, we'll take a look at why Consumer Watchdog is saying that ConocoPhillips is setting off a massive profit orgy among oil companies. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Joni Mitchell.
This is Ralph Nader.
I'm Tim Robbins. You're listening to KPFK.
Wars are the end result of flawed and unjust peace.
We are here as People's Radio, as listener-sponsored radio, as the one true spot on your radio dial that is not controlled or influenced by corporations.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson. You're listening to Radical Free Speech Radio.
KPFK in Los Angeles.
Shows you the power of the people. We are radio powered by the people.
This is an incredible radio station.
There's got to be a media outlet not brought to you by corporations that profit from war, but brought to you by journalists and artists, and that's how Pacifica was born.
This is Howard Dean, and you're listening to the KPFK Los Angeles.
Hi, this is Cindy Sheehan, and you are listening to KPFK.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
Welcome back to Uprising. As oil giant ConocoPhillips reported a record high profit, consumers are still suffering from steep gas prices at the pump. The third largest oil producer in the U.S. posted its largest ever profits of $5.4 billion. Consumer Watchdog, a locally based organization, expects this to kick off what they are calling a, quote, profit orgy by the major oil companies. The group is calling on Congress to act swiftly to address the problem. Democrats have pursued two pieces of legislation focusing on releasing oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and placing restrictions on oil speculators. Both of these actions Consumer Watchdog recommends. Meanwhile, Republicans continue to insist that offshore drilling will lower oil prices, contrary to much evidence in the opposite direction. My guest is Judy Dugan. She is the research director at Consumer Watchdog. Judy, can you tell us what's unusual about ConocoPhillips releasing these record $5.4 billion in profits, I believe, just last week?
The ConocoPhillips report came out last week, and one of the things that was expected, really, was that they would make another record profit. The oil companies in general have been making year-over-year and quarter-over-quarter record profits pretty much since 2003. The interesting thing about this is that they still defend their profits by saying, well, we have bad years and we have good years, and the good years tide us over in the bad years, so we can do what we need to do to explore and get the oil. Well, the point is that they haven't had even a remotely bad year since 2002, and the trend has been far more than historically steadily upward, year-over-year record profits. And ConocoPhillips was the first shot on the oil companies having profits. BP is Tuesday, and then the other oil companies are later in the week, and we're expecting records from all of them.
So ConocoPhillips is basically just kicking off the kind of pattern you expect, a predictable pattern from the rest of the oil industry.
Yeah, it's a profit orgy by big oil. Once again, these companies have been making record profits, making more money than many nations in profit.
So ConocoPhillips is the smallest of the big five oil companies. So even their $5.4 billion in net profits is probably going to be, or maybe the smaller of the numbers that we're going to be seeing in the coming days and weeks.
Absolutely. We expect, of course, that Exxon will make more than double that, Exxon being the largest of them, and the rest should come in somewhere in between.
Now, all of this is happening in the context of more talk of offshore drilling, and the Bush administration, of course, has been chomping at the bit for many years to drill the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR, and the oil companies, of course, very much excited about doing that. What did these numbers, these profits, say to you, who works for a consumer organization, consumer advocacy organization? What did these numbers say to you about offshore oil drilling?
What these huge numbers from the oil companies say to me is that these companies are just looking for more easy money. What they'll do if they get these offshore drilling contracts is not go out there and immediately produce oil to relieve pressure on the market. For one thing, it could take up to 2 to 3 decades to get actual production out of the places that they're talking about. It's just like an uncashed check in their pocket. The truth is that these companies have plenty of places to drill where they have already gotten the leases in less environmentally sensitive locations that they could be developing. One of the things we learned from the ConocoPhillips profit report is that they are actually investing less in actual exploration and production than they did in previous years.
Now, is that on the surface talking about supporting offshore drilling? Is that because they're getting some kind of a financial kickback from the government to at least head in that direction?
They're getting plenty of kickbacks from the government, particularly in terms of what they call royalty relief.
What's that?
That is when the government forgives the payments that the oil companies are supposed to pay to the people of this nation when they strike it on some of the government-controlled and sort of taxpayer-owned land and offshore areas where they are drilling. Now, either deliberately or accidentally, lawmakers made a big mistake in a couple of years in the 90s when they forgot, with quotation marks about it, to put a cap on how high the price of oil had to be before the royalty relief expired. Right now, these oil companies are making immense profits off of public lands because it costs them much, much less to get the oil out of the ground or out of the ocean floor than it does to actually sell it.
My guest is Judy Dugan. She's the research director of Consumer Watchdog, and the organization is pointing out ConocoPhillips' recent report of its profits and predicting that the other oil companies will follow suit in reporting these enormous profits, even as, of course, consumers at the pump are suffering. Now, it's not just consumers. It's, the rest of our economy, essentially, which trickles down to every other aspect of our daily lives, because oil, our economy is based on oil. So it's not just hurting consumers directly at the pump, but indirectly in so many other ways. And I understand Consumer Watchdog had put out a report earlier in the month showing how diesel, which has actually risen even faster in price than expected, used to be cheaper by a few cents than gasoline, but is now actually surpassing that, or is the same as that.
It's surpassing it substantially.
And diesel is, of course, what trucks use, what the transportation of goods and services uses primarily, because it used to be the cheaper alternative. Is that right?
Right. One of the things we're seeing now on diesel prices, which were as high as $5.50 at some places in California, $5.50 a gallon a couple of months ago, and which are still over $5 a gallon in many places, is that the financial year for school districts all over the country, and particularly in California, is a mid-year fiscal year. And school districts are now having to bite the bullet for next year. And what do school buses run on? They run on diesel. And so a lot of school districts are having to either cancel altogether or cut back severely on school buses, even for primary grade students. Hmm. And you've got kids in these little school districts who may live a mile or 2 miles from their schools, and these are little kids. They can't just walk to school by themselves. So we've got a situation in which the price of diesel is putting 6- and 7-year-old kids in danger either of getting into traffic, just trying to get to school, or of missing school when their parents, who may be low income, who may have jobs that they have to get to, can't get them to school.
Not to mention heat exhaustion in the summer heat.
Right.
And, so basically, school. This is, you know, sometimes it's hard to sort of think of all of the ripple effects that the oil prices have. And this is certainly a very important one where, you know, I'm assuming that if school districts do choose to then keep their buses and running, that they might have to make cuts elsewhere, teachers or classroom sizes, et cetera, to make up for this enormous spike.
Right. There's you know, for every penny that diesel goes up, you may well, that may well be a teacher or two teachers or three teachers, depending on the size of the district, that they can't hire. Or it may be one teacher or three teachers that they're going to have to lay off if they keep the school buses running. In many cases, they've decided to axe the school buses instead of the teachers.
Now, Judy, going back to ConocoPhillips, which is the smallest, as I mentioned, of the big five oil companies reporting these record profits, and, you know, as you said, that these companies are saying that, well, they have good years and bad years, and the good years are so they can tide over the bad years. One would expect, and certainly the conventional wisdom is that these profits are then invested back into either renewable sources of energy or into new oil exploration, et cetera. But instead, ConocoPhillips isn't quite doing that with their profits.
No, they, like all of the other major oil companies, are investing half or more of their profits just buying back their own stock.
Just buying back their own stock.
Now, this accomplishes two things for the company. Mm-hmm. One, it'll raise the price of the stock. And two, it's a piggy bank. It's just like putting the money, you know, under your mattress so you can get it out whenever you want it. They can sell stock. They have bought back so much stock over the last 5 years that they can just sell stock at will if they want more money. But it does nothing for exploration, nothing for the environment, nothing for developing fuels of the future. It doesn't even get us more oil because they aren't willing to spend the money. And in fact, they have been spending more money on technology that will get additional oil out of older fields than they have on exploration and production. This was something that came up in a Pew report, a research report in 2007 and again in another update. What they're doing this for is that they will spend the extra money to get more oil out of old fields because it gives them immediate profit at the high prices they're getting today.
And with lower risk.
And with lower risk.
Because they know the oil is
there. They know the oil is there, and they know they can get it out immediately, where what is needed is the new sources of oil if we're going to continue to have at least an economy that is in large part run on oil.
So these oil companies who, through their actions, have been essentially screwing up the economy, making life difficult for people across the board, endangering other industries, are doing what other industries are not doing instead of putting the money into good use that could actually trickle back to relieving the economy, they're pocketing it. And, I mean, this is just such a morally corrupt sort of action to take, but at the same time, they're a business and they have to meet the bottom line.
Well, if they made shoes, who cares? You know, nobody has to go out and buy a new pair of Jimmy Choos just to get to work. But the point about the oil industry is that it may be just It's acting obviously in its own best interest, but oil is an industry. It's more like an electric utility. You can't do without it. Not in the economy that the world has today, not in the transportation fuel infrastructure that the world has today. So we have an industry that is highly concentrated, uncompetitive, and for which people who use energy have no good alternative right now.
And certainly not on the scale of an entire economy. So really, barring some serious legislation to regulate these industries, they're going to run or continue to run roughshod over the entire economy. Judy, what does Consumer Watchdog recommend needs to be done?
Well, it's in two parts, really. One is the markets on which oil is traded, the futures markets, which have been deregulated to the point where it's almost impossible to say what speculation is doing to the market. This is something that Congress has a tiptoe in this issue, but even so, they've been unable so far to pass the mildest bit of oversight. One small bill did pass, but only because it was tucked into the giant farm bill, which had a lot of other support and couldn't be affected so much by oil lobbying. But there are a number of other bills that are simply stuck and can't even get a vote, particularly in the Senate.
You know, and this is at a time when the White House is reporting record deficits, saying that the next president of the United States is going to have this gaping hole in the economy.
Which is due in some part to energy costs.
Sure, exactly. And so here we are with the Congress that is not acting to regulate these oil companies. I mean, essentially, the whole economy, there is a solution staring them in the face, and they're not taking it. And you mentioned oil lobbying.
There are several solutions. One is to get new rules on trading. So it's not just, you know, people who are actually breaking the law that need some regulation. It's many other aspects of this market, including how cheap it is to gamble in this market. It costs much less to enter these markets than it does the stock market, where you have to put up 50% minimum of the cost of the stock that you're betting on. In oil, it's 5%. It's crazy because it allows
gambling.
gamblers, essentially, to control far too much oil. Mm. The other one is using some part of these huge profits that oil companies are making, especially the part of the profit that is due directly to various taxpayer subsidies. Either they can do real research, real development of alternative and renewable fuels, or that money should come back to the taxpayers to subsidize solar, wind, electric, all of the technologies that show so much promise but have not had stable funding, which is what they need to become competitors to oil.
I mean, just looking at these profits, it is so unconscionable that on top of these profits, these companies would be getting taxpayer subsidies.
Yes, and there was a recent study by the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, that said these royalty payments, that the companies overall may be getting up to $53 billion over several years.
Wonderful.
Just because of these unseemly royalty relief bills, you know, that they're getting a kickback from the taxpayers. At the other end of the market, what you want to do is the refining end. Now, this year, refining profits have been down, and the oil companies, despite their record profits, have been moaning and groaning to investors about how their refinery profits aren't as big as they used to be. There is no control at all on refinery profits. And in 2006 and in 2007, refinery profits went through the roof in the spring. There was a point where, particularly in California, more than a dollar a gallon was going to refineries, which is completely unconscionable. And so if they're not getting us on the price of oil, they're getting us on refinery profits.
Well, Judy Dugan, where can listeners find out more about what Consumer Watchdog is doing about or how they're holding, how your group is holding oil companies accountable?
We just try to stick a sharp stick in their side as often as possible, just to remind them that we're looking at these things from a consumer viewpoint and reminding legislators that they have a responsibility. Right now, online at oilwatchdog.org and consumerwatchdog.org, we have a letter that people can send to Congress saying, here's my gas bill. Here's what I paid. It's called Send Your Gas Bill to Congress. And then it calls for these market regulations to get the price of oil down and invest more money in renewables.
Judy Dugan is Research Director at Consumer Watchdog, and you can find out more at consumerwatchdog.org and oilwatchdog.org. You are listening to Uprising, and after this short break, we will take a look at the housing relief bill that Congress just passed and that President Bush is about to sign. Will it really bring relief? Stay tuned to find out. Welcome back to Uprising. The Senate approved the Housing and Economy Recovery Act of 2008 last Saturday as home foreclosures continued to mount. According to new data released by Realty Track Incorporated, foreclosure filings in the second quarter more than doubled compared to last year. Nearly 750,000 homes across the nation received foreclosure-related notices during the second quarter of this year. The housing relief bill, which now awaits a signature from President Bush, will apparently provide aid to an estimated 400,000 homeowners. However, critics contend that the actual number of those who will be able to save their homes in the form of new mortgages at 85% of their appraised value is closer to 260,000. As many as 140,000 homeowners who would bring their failing mortgages to the Federal Housing Authority under the bill could actually end up facing second foreclosure. Additionally, the bill contains emergency financing for mortgage backers Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as the U.S. Treasury would be allowed to buy shares in and provide credit to the two. The housing crisis in the context of the American sluggish economy is expected to continue into next year, with an estimated 2.5 to 3 million additional foreclosures predicted. My guest is Jane Darista. She is an economic analyst at the Financial Markets Center, which monitors the Federal Reserve, as well as financial markets. Welcome to Uprising, Jane.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks very much for joining us. First, let's talk about the assistance to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I mean, we hear these mortgage backers' names a lot, but for those of us who are not economists, explain what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are and how exactly this bill essentially shores up these two institutions.
Well, Fannie Mae was actually founded in 1938 as part of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, an agency that had actually been enacted by Herbert Hoover to provide capital to failing banks. By 1938, the mortgage situation was desperate, and the need for financing for mortgages and for better financing for mortgages, the Fannie Mae actually invented the fixed rate amortized loan. Along in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, there was great pressure to privatize the Fannie Mae, and that was eventually done. And yet there was a government guarantee. So this kind of quasi-public status, it's called a government-sponsored enterprise, as is Freddie Mac, which was subsequently in 1972 founded. The idea to assist in the American homeowner to buy mortgages, to make mortgage credit more readily available, the market doesn't do all alone a great job in that, as many other countries have found as well. So over time, of course, this became a very large part of credit allocation in the United States. And many people have been somewhat critical of that, saying that it has focused the credit flow into housing, which is not a tradable good, at a time when the U.S. was losing its competitiveness in the world and when we were losing our manufacturing capacity. So that's out there, too. But the excesses of recent years in mortgage markets and with the support of Fannie and Freddie, and the very fact that these two agencies now either own or guarantee $5 trillion worth of mortgages has made it absolutely necessary to prevent them from failing. Hmm. How it might have been done better is open to a lot of discussion, has been discussed widely. A lot of people are saying, just why don't we just nationalize them? This partial nationalization of buying their stock, et cetera, helping them out through the Federal Reserve's discount window is probably not enough. Meanwhile, what is really going on, I think, at this point is the concern for stopping this absolute fall in housing prices, which is helping to make even more fragile a financial sector, and in particular, it is extending the credit crunch. Whenever housing prices fall in value, the value of the securities that have been sold and are held widely across the system, not just by banks and investment banks and insurance companies, hedge funds, and pension funds as well, falls in value. And in the case of institutions that have to mark to market or have to take losses, and that's banks as well, what you're seeing is that they are losing capital. So unless we can put a floor under the price of housing, we are going to continue to see a meltdown in the financial capital of our system. And that's very dangerous and very frightening.
Hmm.
So all of these measures that have been enacted so far, they're good. I mean, they have to be done. But I don't think anybody believes that's the final word on any of this.
Now, there is another bill proposed by Representative Grijalva, the Saving Family Homes Act, which would allow many homeowners facing foreclosure to actually stay in their homes by basically renting, you know, paying rent to the banks and being able to remain in their homes for up to 20 years. It apparently does not require any taxpayer dollars and no new bureaucracy. Why? What do you think of this bill, and why has Congress not taken this up, which seems to help homeowners more directly than the corporate entities?
Well, I think that's a very good proposal. That and many others which are directed primarily to the homeowner. There are problems there because some of these so-called renters, potential renters, could not pay the you'd have to set the rent value. And who's going to do that? I mean, I'm not sure what the legislation really covers there. I have not read the legislation. But it's a little bit complicated, and it's a little bit complicated because so many of these mortgages are held in pools and then securitized so that people own a slice of this pool. They don't own an individual mortgage. Part of the problem of securitization has been sorting it out so that the lending institution originating the mortgage could actually work with the homeowner to bring down either the interest rate or the principal et cetera. And that's why some people have proposed also that the federal government should simply go out and in an auction fashion buy these securities and begin to unravel them and get at the original homeowners through the Federal Home Loan Administration and try to do the loan workouts.
Now, wouldn't that require a lot more sort of institutional, you know, creating more institutional support in the government, and wouldn't that also in the end cost perhaps a lot of money?
It would cost money. Yes, absolutely it would cost money, but we are going to be spending a lot of money on this problem. One way or another, it's, I mean, the expectation is that under the current legislation, which is about to be signed, the cost will be at least $100 billion.
Hmm.
So, but if you were to buy these at a discount, buy these securities at a discount in an auction situation, taking the lowest price, you might come out a little bit better, and you might solve the problem more quickly because the longer it extends, the more money we're going to end up spending.
My guest is Jane Darista. She's an economic analyst at the Financial Markets Center, which monitors the Federal Reserve as well as financial markets. We're talking about the housing relief bill that Congress just passed. It's awaiting President Bush's signature. So I understand that the bill, one aspect of the bill that is quite positive, at least as per the National Low Income Housing Coalition, is that it establishes a housing trust fund, the first national housing trust fund dedicated to producing and preserving rent homes for the lowest income people in the U.S. What do you think of this, and is it enough, particularly in terms of protecting renters, which are so often forgotten?
Yes, I think that's a very important thing to do, and I think, you know, this is an innovation. One of the, you know, one of the upsides of having crisis situation is that you can actually get innovation into the system. Such a provision would never have been ever considered a couple of years ago. But it's an important provision. The other part of the bill which is important is dealing with the problems of communities, and in particular with the cities and the areas that have been so blighted by these foreclosures, and trying to get at that problem as well. The president doesn't like it, but it is necessary to do it. So many, you know, hopefully down the road, this will not be the last piece of legislation. There will be refinements, and there will be more programs in it that are very positive and very helpful.
So let's talk specifically about what homeowners or those who are thinking of buying homes for the first time can expect out of just this bill alone. First-time home buyers are supposedly going to get some help. What exactly can people expect if they are considering buying a home?
Well, there's a new program that has been proposed. In fact, I think it came out yesterday from the Treasury for a covered bonds, a new way of ensuring that there will be mortgage lending. The problem at the moment is it just isn't happening. The Federal Reserve has lowered interest rates, and mortgage rates are going up. So mortgages are not being made. The fear today is, well, we're looking at the New York Times yesterday and seeing that the banks are not lending for businesses as well. And that is for medium-sized businesses. For small businesses, toward the end of the mortgage, the housing boom, they were also not lending to small businesses as such. They were asking them to provide as collateral their primary residences. And so they were securitizing, they were doing the mortgage lending in order to finance small business. Small business has been in a very difficult situation in terms of lending. So we have a credit crunch. I mean, in addition to the problem of foreclosure and housing prices, we also have the problem of the money is not getting out to keep the economy going.
So basically the companies are hanging on to their money as hard as possible.
That's right. They're mm-hmm. afraid to lend.
Which in turn is going to make things worse. Is there anything in this bill that is going to, I mean, of course, whenever we accept the current system as it's set up, we then have to look at it from the perspective of, well, how can we help make these lenders more, you know, able to lend, which means in the end securing their risks with taxpayer money. So is that actually happening in this bill?
Not specifically in this bill. What we're looking at is the new Treasury proposal, which goes at the omissions in this bill, which is how do we get mortgage lending and lending in general to resume. Mm. As I pointed out earlier, the problem here is as assets in general, I mean, whether it be housing, commercial real estate, consumer loans, et cetera, begin to fall in value. As losses are taken, the financial institutions write those off, Wachovia, Merrill Lynch, whomever they may be, and that means they write them off against capital. They have less capital. They have rules. They cannot add new assets, new loans, unless they raise capital. Now, where is the capital coming from? There's no place. There's no place. Mm-hmm. Unless we're taking it again from the sovereign wealth funds abroad, in the oil exporting countries in the Middle East or Singapore or China, and they are beginning to back off. because they already hold about $900 billion of mortgage-backed securities.
Not to mention the dollar is falling so rapidly.
Exactly so.
Finally, Jane, let's talk in the last few minutes about something you raised near the beginning of this interview, which is the concept of nationalizing, essentially, the mortgage industry. I mean, this is a country that has been built on the concept of home ownership as a very strong pillar of American life.
Yes.
Where do you see, you know, how could this current system, a big mess as it is today, it seems as though we're just sort of patching the leaks as they spring up. But what would a nationalized mortgage industry look like?
Well, in a sense, you would continue Fannie and Freddie doing the kinds of things that they do, but with a great deal more scrutiny from the government and the Congress, hopefully. It would be a question then of slowly allowing the housing prices to fall in an orderly manner, because they will have to fall. But at the same time, allowing a floor to develop so that they don't fall too rapidly by extending new mortgages. So you would have to devise a system that would the federal government ownership of this. It would be clear taxpayer responsibility. That would mean then that if that responsibility were clear, you would be able to sell the securities of Fannie and Freddie, not only in our own markets, but perhaps to foreigners once again, in order to attract the money that is needed to get through this problem.
But what you're describing is still sort of partial nationalization.
Well, no, because the federal government itself, of course, continues to fund its own deficits by selling its securities in the market. This would be a situation in which, once you've turned around this situation, once you have Fannie and Freddie in a place where they are not losing money, the federal government can then recoup what it's put into it. I mean, a lot of people were very concerned about the Bear Stearns situation because they pointed out that the federal government, the Federal Reserve, gave a $30 billion guarantee in that situation and got nothing back. They took the risk without any possibility of lending. And people were saying, well, why aren't we behaving like the sovereign wealth funds who have preferred stock?
Right. Well, Jane, unfortunately, we're out of time. Any last thoughts? And where can listeners find out more about the Financial Market Center? Is there a website?
Yes, there is, fmcenter.org.
fmcenter.org. We'll link to that from our site. Jane Darista, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Jane Darista is an economic analyst at the Financial Markets Center. fmcenter.org is the website. It's a group that monitors the Federal Reserve. You are listening to Uprising, and for Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, "Be as beneficent as the sun or the sea, but if your rights as a rational being are trenched on, die on the first inch of your territory." That's Ralph Waldo Emerson. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Tamika Zoki is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website, linked via kpfk.org. Just click on Programs in the left column and follow the links. Our email address is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'll be on vacation for the next week, and we'll be back live next Wednesday. But for the next 3 days, you can hear a three-part series, The 1968 Revolution Rewind. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I didn't wanna sit for about two.